Let's get started. This is a spectroscopy session. Welcome all to the spectroscopy session. Let's get started. So we have some one theoretical work by Thomas Dahm, and then there's some experimental work. So yesterday, just a brief introduction. Yesterday I saw somebody wearing a t-shirt that said, superconductivity is no longer cool. Well, that could be looked at two ways. From the optimist point of view, that means, yes, we're going to get really room temperature superconductivity. From the pessimist point of view, means the field is a mess. Every time some new sample or new experiment gets published, some new effect comes along, and we're just getting more and more confused. So how are we going to get our thoughts straight if we can't get our facts straight? So the onus is upon experimentalists, us, to try to sort out the field. And I don't think we're taking it seriously enough, because sometimes we're just too happy to stir up the pot. Maybe we should let it settle a little bit and take the grease out of the pot. So those comments motivated my question. So really, it's important to state what are the assumptions that go into your data analysis, because we want to know really how much of it is a consequence of the assumptions that you put in, and how much is just a general statement from the data. So perhaps it would be nice if you explain what are the assumptions in these experiments. And the big question, of course, is can we make progress without these assumptions, or do we need them? So this confusion about experimental results, are they really a consequence of the complexity in the system, or is it that different samples actually do have different ground states? Since they are competing interactions, we probably all would think that or agree to that. So the question is, when you change the system slightly, and perhaps the solid state chemist can help us here, do you really have a different sample, or is it the same? So just nominally the same. So we really have to answer this question, or we're really going to keep being misled by red herrings, as we were discussing earlier. So can we do something to clear this up, or is funding so dire that we have to keep stirring up the pot? I don't know the answer. Let's hope that we hear something of that today. So let's get started with Thomas Dahm.
Okay. So can you hear me? So I would like to report on a collaboration I did together with the inelastic neutron scattering group by Bernhard Keimer in Stuttgart and the photoemission group of Sergei Borisenko at the IFW in Dresden, and Werner Hanke and Doug Scalapino. And this work was published in January this year. So let me start to ask, how do we know that the pairing mechanism in the conventional superconductors is due to phonons? And if you look at a BCS superconductor, you have no chance to find that out experimentally, because BCS is a universal limit, and all superconductors behave the same way except for the scale of TC. You get a chance when the electron-phonon coupling becomes stronger, and then, as you know, there's this Macmillan and Raoul procedure. And the idea of this is that if the interaction is strong enough, you start to see some fingerprints of the phonons appearing in the electronic properties. For example, here in the tunneling density of states in lead, the dashed line is the BCS expectation, and you see there are deviations from this. And then the idea of Macmillan and Raoul was to try to extract the spectrum of the boson that is producing these structures. And the result is shown down here. That's the spectrum you get by inverting Migdal-Eliasberg equations. And you can compare the spectrum with the phonon density of states that you can measure by inelastic neutron scattering. And by comparing these two pictures, you conclude, okay, this must be the phonon. And I call this circumstantial evidence, because by doing such kind of a proof, you're acting like a criminal inspector. You're taking a fingerprint at the place of the crime. This is done by tunneling and inverting Michaelis-Jaschbeck equations. And then you have some suspect, in this case it's the phonon, and you're taking the fingerprint of the phonon by inelastic neutron scattering, and then you compare these two. The question is, can we do something similar in high TC cup rates? And there are several problems. First of all, may we still use Migdal-Eliasberg theory? Is it still valid? At least this quantity is not small anymore. Another point is we know that these systems are D-wave superconductors, so necessarily you need a strong momentum dependence of the interaction, so you cannot work anymore with momentum integrated quantities. You need to take into account the momentum dependence. So if you want to do something similar, you need to go to momentum resolved techniques. Of course, these exist. Angular resolved photoemission spectroscopy and inelastic neutron scattering can also be done momentum dependent. The problem, some practical problem, is that the high quality data in photoemission are usually available on the BISCO system because this has high surface quality, while the inelastic neutron scattering is usually done on YBCO because there you can grow large single crystals. So these are two different systems. The question is, can we relate structures in inelastic neutron scattering and photoemission spectroscopy? Of course, there are structures. The most prominent one, I would say, is the photoemission kink. And yeah, as you know, what is curious about the kink is that it seems to appear always at the same energy position, and independent of the material, independent of the doping, and even independent of temperature. So it seems to be there also above and below TC. And so it has been argued that this could be a phonon, looks like a phonon structure because it's just stable in energy. And in particular, it cannot be explained by the resonance peak in the inelastic neutron scattering spectrum because the peak does depend on doping and it disappears in the normal state. So question, is it a phonon structure? And if it is that phonon strong enough to produce D-wave superconductivity? And I mentioned recent LDA calculations by the Karlsruhe group and the Berkeley group that raised doubts whether the electron-phonon interaction is strong enough to produce the kink. So the new features of our study are the following. So YBCO 6.6 samples from Stuttgart were first investigated with high-resolution inelastic neutron scattering. Then the same samples were measured by the Dresden group using angular resolved photoemission. So we are really trying to use the same material. And then Vladimir Hinkov from Bernhard Keimer's group provided an analytic fitting formula for the measured spin excitation spectrum. This fitting formula is fully momentum and frequency dependent. And he has done this at two temperatures, at 5 Kelvin in the superconducting state and at 70 Kelvin in the normal state. And using this fitting formula, I have used it to make a calculation of the photoemission spectra that you should expect from interacting with these spin excitations and try to relate structures in these two experimental techniques. So this is what Hinkov's formula gives me. This is the well-known hourglass shape of the spin excitation spectrum. You see momentum versus energy. This is the anti-ferromagnetic wave vector. You have this resonance peak here. And then you have this dispersion downwards in energy, and you have this so-called upper branch dispersing upwards in energy. So, and from Sergei Borisenko, I got the measured Fermi surface. YBCO is a two-plane system, so we have two bands, a bonding and antibonding band, and you have a bilayer splitting, which is approximately constant everywhere. That's different to BISCO, and this is the renormalized Fermi surface, I would say. So, and then the philosophy of my calculation is to avoid theory as much as possible and take as much information from the experiment as feasible, and then calculate the self-energy diagram using spin excitations here and using the self-consistent calculation for the Green's function. And the features of these calculations are that I'm taking full momentum and energy dependence into account. I'm taking into account AB plane anisotropy. I'm taking into account two copper oxygen planes per unit cell. And this calculation is done self-consistently. And yeah, one new feature of this calculation is that I'm fixing the renormalized Fermi surface. So as the Fermi surface that is given to me by Borisenko is the one which comes out at the end, I need to make sure during the calculation that at the end I will have that Fermi surface. So in each iterative step, I'm readjusting the unrenormalized band structure in such a way that I reproduce the renormalized Fermi surface. But there's one quantity which I cannot get from extract from Borisenko's data. This is the unrenormalized nodal Fermi velocity. Or if you want, Borisenko can tell me the shape of the Fermi surface, but not what the unrenormalized bandwidth is. So I need to assume some number, and I'm taking a value from Ola Andersen's band structure calculation. So this is one number which I could not get from experiment, but otherwise the spectrum and the Fermi surface are taken from the experimental data. And then I'm adjusting the coupling strength. This is my only fitting parameter, if you want. So I'm adjusting this coupling strength such as to reproduce the renormalized nodal Fermi velocity that is observed in the photo emission. So this is how it looks like. This is the nodal dispersion. The crosses are data points from Borisenko, and the solid line is the result of my calculation. And the blue line, I'm just indicating to you the low energy renormalized Fermi velocity. It's no surprise that this agrees well down here because I have adjusted the coupling strength in such a way to get that slope. But it's not clear that these two curves agree downwards here. And you notice that the theoretical calculation has a kink, but there are no phonons in these calculations. So where is that kink coming from? And now my advantage is that I can look into my calculation and analyze where it's coming from. So how can I do that? So let's look at the T equals zero imaginary part of the self-energy that depends on momentum and energy. And at zero temperature, it is a momentum average over the imaginary part of the spin susceptibility. And as a variable, you have to put here K minus K prime and epsilon K prime minus omega. So given K and omega, I can resolve this and try to find out where the largest contributions are coming from. And since I'm interested in the kink, I put myself with the K at that nodal point. And for a few omega, I'm analyzing the contributions as a function of K prime. And since that is an interband scattering process, I'm basically looking at the dashed Fermi surface for K prime. Yes. Yes. No, what? This is momentum dependent. It depends on K. No, G I'm taking to be constant. Why? No, but that's taken into account here. Okay, maybe you will be surprised. I don't know. So let's look where the contributions are coming from. I'm putting myself at minus 20 millielectron volts below the Fermi surface, and you see some stuff over here. So there are some small contributions coming from that area to that point here. Now I'm going to increase the energy, and you see still green, not very strong, but there's some contributions from the opposite nodal point. I'm increasing to 60 millielectron volts, some stuff over here. And now we are coming to the kink energy, 80 millielectron volts, and you see some red stuff coming up here. And then we continue to increase the energy, and it's getting more and more. So the contributions are coming from the opposite node in the other band. And you notice that there is a strong onset at about minus 80 millielectron volts in this calculation. So how can we interpret that? So apparently it's a scattering from two different nodal points in the different bands. And this momentum vector, which connects these two parts, is smaller than the anti-ferromagnetic wave vector. It's about 74% of the nodal vector. And apparently, the kink structure is generated by some process which starts at 80 millielectron volts. So let's draw that momentum vector into the hourglass shape. And what you notice is that this line hits the upper branch at around 80 millielectron volts. Yeah, so in this calculation, the kink is made by the upper branch of the hourglass spin excitations. Yeah? So below 80 millielectron volts, these two electrons cannot interact because there's not much scattering available. But as soon as you reach 80 millielectron volts, a new process becomes possible. And this leads me to suggest a new interpretation of the kink. Yeah? So because this upper branch, this is known as universal and common to all high TC cup rates. And that part is also very much temperature and doping independent. So by that scattering mechanism, you should actually expect that this stays at the same position. Yeah, independent of doping temperature. It should also be seen in the normal state. We will see that soon. And you can also look at the antinodal region. These are the data from Borisenko. These are the calculations. And you see, first of all, this peak dip hump feature in both experimental data and theoretical calculation. This black line is the unrenormalized Fermi a band structure, and you see that it's strongly renormalized here, but it's of the same order as in the experiment without a second adjustable parameter. So I just have used one single parameter, which is the constant coupling. Constant. Okay, and you can make a similar interpretation here. So let's look from this point to this point. This momentum vector is about 95% of the anti-ferromagnetic wave vector, and you can also draw it in here. And then you see here you have a strong interaction with the resonance. Yeah? So you should expect this feature to disappear when you go into the normal state. And so let's look into the normal and superconducting state. This is in the nodal direction, and you see at 5 Kelvin and in the normal state at 70 Kelvin, you both have the kink. And while in the antinodal direction, you have the peak dip hump feature at 5 Kelvin and it disappears at 70 Kelvin. So it's very nice. Now what we can do on top, so the coupling constant that comes out of this calculation, the one that I need to reproduce the renormalized Fermi velocity is 1.6 eV. And I can use that coupling constant now to calculate a TC. If I assume that the spin excitation spectrum above 70 Kelvin stays the same, which is of course not true. So this will be an overestimate, but not much. And I get 174 Kelvin if I do that. So now several effects have been neglected in these calculations. So what might be their impact? So first of all, one number I've taken from a not from experiment is the unrenormalized nodal Fermi velocity. So I reduced it by 20%, and then I see that TC drops down to 140 Kelvin. There is no pseudo gap in this calculation, so I put in some pseudo gap by hand into the normal state, 30 MeV, and then I observe that TC increases by 20% because the low energy part of the spectrum is gapped out. And yeah, then I checked what happens if I cut off the spin excitation spectrum at 200 millielectron volts just to see what is the high energy part doing. And then TC just decreases by 1 Kelvin, so you can see that everything below 200 MeV is basically doing the pairing. Okay. And finally, there are no phonons in this calculation, but the calculations by the Karlsruhe group suggest that the phonons have a coupling strength of about lambda of 0.3. So if I assume that, then TC drops by 10%. So that's still large numbers. You know, there's some large uncertainty, but it's not that by including these corrections that that the TC is completely lost. So to summarize, we have used a phenomenological approach. We try to rely only on experimental data. And during the analysis of these results, we basically stumbled upon a new interpretation of the kink. The calculation gives you a high value of TC. I claim it's the most realistic calculation so far. I have checked that the results are reasonably stable. And I claim that the ARPA structure can be related to structures in the spin excitation spectrum. So the kink is related to the upper branch of the spin excitation spectrum, while the peak de pump is related to the resonance structure. Thank you very much.
Question?
Yeah, as with regard to the interpretation of the kink in another direction being related to the upper size of our class, I do remember data, neutron scattering data from Rutherford. I forgot who precisely the authors were, but they made a point that when you look at the way the hour class develops as functional doping, that when you are at optimal doping, you only see spin fluctuation in a very narrow range around the resonance itself, meaning that also that high energy piece is wiped out when you go to high dopings. And I was very much impressed by it because it was kind of telling me that so there are large scale changes.
Which doping level was optimal?
6.92123, okay, that I remember. You know what I'm talking about? They looked at spectral waves, right? They basically, I guess, integrated over Q to get sort of spectral wave plots as function of omega, showing that it really gets very narrowly concentrated around the resonance at optimal doping.
The integrated spectral weight is, of course, decreasing when you go more overdoped. Yeah, that's a fact. And so it becomes more and more difficult to measure the full spectrum. That's what Keimer told me. Yeah. So it may be hidden behind the error, below the error bars, the remaining part of the spectrum. Yes. What we are talking about?
So the high branches of the hour class, right?
This
where
one.
You say that's
yes. Okay. 80 years.
What I remember is that at optimal dose, 1.2, 6.92, mm-hmm. They basically have no spectral length at 100 MeV.
Okay.
Yep.
No. Okay. Yes.
Can I? Yeah. very small comment. I think Mike and I put very similar description of kink or crossover or whatever. But two questions. First is how you know that you calculate TC, not T star, viewed as the onset of pain. And second, the green function and you know the interaction, did you try to estimate what the strength of vertex correction is?
No, I view this, I'm adjusting the coupling constant such as to reproduce experimental data, so it will be a renormalized coupling constant already. So does it make sense to calculate vertex corrections on top of that? I would say no. It doesn't. Yes, and so it seems by looking at these two momentum points, by antinodal region and nodal region, that I can get good agreement by assuming just the same constant.
Is there any difficulty with the fact that the neutron scattering is a truly bulk measurement, whereas the ARPES can be a surface measurement? Yep. Because you're combining, it's wonderful it's on the same sample, but you're still combining measurements that are measuring potentially different things.
Yes. Yeah, we had to make a compromise. Yeah? So neutron scattering is put in YVCO, and in particular, the more you go underdoped, it gets better, the resolution. While in photoemission, it's just opposite. Yeah? First of all, YVCO is not a very good system for angular resolved photoemission. And secondly, here the data go better when you go more overdoped. So in some sense, the 6.6 is a compromise where you have data in both experimental techniques. So what was the other question? Yeah, the question, yes. Yeah. Okay, Borisenko is telling me that he sees the overdoped surface component, but he claims that this data is from the bulk inside.
Two very quick questions. The first one is related to 2 on 4. I mean, other single copper oxygen playing compounds, people have seen kinks, and you don't have interbind process there to begin with.
They can see kinks.
Yes. Is then the mechanism? You don't have interbind scattering.
Well, then, of course, you also have this hourglass, yeah. But it's
so
in
it's
that case
the same band.
Intra-band scattering.
Okay. The second question is, how did you calculate TC to begin with? You use BCS formula or what?
No, I'm using the Eliasberg theory, the linearized TC equation. So Andre would say it's T star actually. Yeah.
You mentioned that. Lower frequency part with pair breaking.
Yes.
Do you have anything more regarding that pair breaking that I haven't seen?
I have done this. So it's interesting to know where is the pairing coming from in this calculation. And I have done this Bergmann-Reiner analysis. So which part of this spectrum, this is the normal state spectrum, and which parts are responsible for the TC. And you can do this by calculating this functional derivative of TC with respect to the spin susceptibility versus momentum and energy. This is the Bergmann and Reiner analysis. Yeah. And if you do that, you get this picture. So red means negative, green means positive. So the part of the spectrum that is below that energy, about 20 millielectron volts, that is pair breaking, and the part of the spectrum that is above that energy here, this is pair binding, and the maximum is around 70 millielectron volt at the antiferromagnetic wave vector. And yeah, we can, for the fun of it, multiply these two pictures to see, to get this picture. And here you see that in this calculation, the TC is made mainly by the upper branch of the spin excitation spectrum. So I find that interesting because it tells you that the upper branch might be an important part in a spin fluctuation theory, yeah, to both get the kink and to get the TC. Yeah. And as far as I know, theories so far had difficulties to get the upper branch of the the hourglass. So my suggestion would be trying to focus on getting the upper branch of the hourglass into the spin fluctuation theories. Okay.
Well, thanks. Let's thank the speaker and move on to the next talk. Next talk is by Tom Kinnisk on self-energy spectroscopy of superconductors. If the, this paper by Lansara that you mentioned says that the kink is universal, there's the only other universal energy scale other than the Planck constant, so I don't know where that, that's a bit too much. But anyway, if that thing is not moving in energy, while TC is, does it have any relevance to TC?